Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Before we turn to State House issues, a big criminal trial took place last week involving Blendon Township Police Officer Connor Grubb. The jury acquitted Grubb of murder and other charges in the fatal shooting of 21-year-old Takiyah Young, who was 7 months pregnant. Joining us now is WOSU reporter George Shilcock, who covered the trial. Thanks for being here, George.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
So clearly an emotional trial. I wanted to play some audio that you captured in court on Friday. Here's Takiyah Young's grandmother, Nadine Young, reacting to the verdict.
You can walk away crazy, never look in. All right.
And Connor Grubb did not speak to reporters, but his attorney, Mark Collins, did, saying he understands the pain and frustration of Young's family and what they're experiencing. He also said this about Grubb.
For the rest of his life, he has to deal with this. And he, trust me, you didn't get to hear from him because the government put his statement on, but he took a life on duty and realized another's life after the fact. And to walk around with that and that is a difficult situation.
So, George, give us a sense of the scene when the verdict was read. What was that like?
Yeah. So the courtroom was filled with families on both sides, right? Nadine Young was surrounded by her own family and supporters, lawyers that are representing her and her family in civil court. And then Grubb had also his supporters, family, the FOP president was there. It was a packed courtroom, and there was definitely, like, this silence in the room waiting for the judge to rule and waiting to hear what would come back with these six charges.
Over the weekend, there was a group of about 20 activists who protested the verdict outside the State House. What message were they trying to get across with that protest?
Mm-hmm. These protesters who were with it was partially organized by the Party for Socialism and Liberation here in Columbus. They obviously disagreed with the verdict, and they were saying that, you know, Grubb should have been found guilty on these charges, and a lot of their message centered around like how the justice system didn't get it right in this case. That was what they argued.
Let's remind listeners of what happened. This is back in 2023. So Young was accused of shoplifting in August of 2023 at the Sunbury Road Kroger. What happened next in the grocery store parking lot?
Mm-hmm. So there were two officers there that day, Grubb and Sergeant Moynihan. They were both doing different things in the parking lot when a Kroger employee came up and alerted them saying, hey, this woman just stole liquor from the store. Connor Grubb was at the time trying to open a woman's locked car when he saw Sergeant Moynihan approach Young's vehicle and say, hey, get out of the car. Grubb walked over to the car. And on body camera video, it's all on the video, and he placed himself in front of Takiyah Young's car and also repeated that order, get out of the car, and he pulled out his gun. That's when in the video we see Takiyah Young turning her car to the right, away from Grubb, and then starting to pull away. And this is where things get a little, this is where the arguments in court started, whether the car struck him or not, and you see the car pull forward, him starting to tread backward as if he was hit or maybe just trying to avoid the car and then shooting once through the windshield, hitting her.
Mm-hmm. There's, well, let's talk about the charges. So Grubb was originally charged with 10 counts, but then some of that was dropped during the trial. Did the judge explain why?
Yes. So after all testimony from the prosecution was over, this happens in a lot of trials. The defense will ask for the judge to dismiss charges, right? And in this case, they argued, hey, we have these murder charges and felonious assault charges that say Officer Grubb also killed Young's unborn child, right? And the defense argued the prosecution didn't present any evidence that Grubb knew she was pregnant. So when you're saying someone committed first-degree murder and felonious assault against someone, you kind of have to prove that they knowingly did so. Mm-hmm. And the prosecution, according to the defense, didn't do so. The judge agreed and decided to dismiss those charges before the jury started deliberating. But of course, there were still six charges left over for killing Takiyah Young. Mm-hmm.
Police body cam video and the surveillance video from the Kroger all played a key role. Do you know what evidence seemed to resonate with the jurors? Was it that body cam video from Connor Grubb's body cam, or was there other things that seemed to resonate with the jury?
It was really hard to tell and get a read on the jury. I think part of what this trial centered around, of course, wasn't whether he killed Takiyah Young. Mm-hmm. It's whether he was justified in doing so. Mm-hmm. And I think it really came down to the defense's argument of Grubb was in the path of a moving vehicle, and vehicles can severely injure someone, even if they're going at a slow speed. And that's what the defense argued. And they showed injuries that Grubb apparently got that day, and sort of argued, hey, he was right to fear for his life in this situation. He could have been more severely injured. And that was their argument. Whether they proved it or not, it seems like the jury seemed to agree with that, yeah, he feared for his life. There was a car, and a car can be a weapon.
Now, Grubb never testified in his own defense. Do we know why not?
So if you listen to defense lawyers, they will argue that it's because of the prosecution. The prosecution, one of their witnesses was one of the lead state investigators on this case, and they had him read into the record a statement that Connor Grubb gave, like the day or the day after the shooting. I'm sorry, I can't recall when he did it, but it was right after the shooting, right? And in it, Grubb describes this, in this written statement, Grubb describes how he feared for his life and that he viewed there was no other option but to do so. To aim center mass at Takiyah Young and shoot her in order to stop the threat of that car.
And so someone read that in court, or
yes,
they played it? Okay.
I believe state investigator Kyle Douglas. And the defense then went on to say there was a question about whether he would still testify. But then in closing arguments and post-verdict, the defense lawyers told us, yeah, they read his statement and that's all he really had to say. So we didn't have to put him on the stand. Would he have testified if they didn't put that statement up? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that's what the defense lawyers argued, is he didn't have to.
And Takiyah, this all started because Takiyah Young was suspected of stealing liquor from the store. Did they conclude that she did steal something from the store?
Well, of course, she passed away and she was never tried in a court. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But surveillance footage shows her both in the store, taking these liquor bottles, putting them in a bag and leaving. And then after she was shot and taken from the car, state investigators found that she had that bag and it had the liquor bottles in it.
You're listening to All Sides and our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking right now with WOSU reporter George Shilcock about the criminal trial of Blendon Township Police Officer Connor Grubb. He was acquitted of all charges in the fatal shooting of Takiyah Young. The shooting occurred back in 2023. What was the makeup of the jury? How diverse was it? And I know something happened. There was a medical situation with one of the jurors, too.
Yes. Yeah, so after the first day of deliberation, they had to start over because one juror had a medical emergency, a surgery. I think that's how the judge described it. And they could no longer continue. In that case, they put one of the alternates in. There are four alternates to add to the 12-person jury should something happen. And they replaced it. As to the jury diversity, it was mostly women. There was one black person on the main jury and then one as an alternate. And that was sort of the makeup of it. The person who had surgery, I believe, was a white woman.
Do you know how long was the trial? Was it, I can't remember when it, what day it started. Was it like 2 weeks?
Early November is when opening statements and jury selection began. And so I'd say about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I think even when the
defense days all blend
said,
together. Yeah.
It kind of just felt like it took a very long time.
The jury deliberated for 2 days, though, right?
Two and a half days.
Okay. Yeah. And they were delayed a little bit because of the changing of one juror.
Yes. Yeah. They had to start completely over.
Well, ever since the George Floyd killing by police and the worldwide protests that followed, there's been a keen interest in these types of cases and how they're handled by prosecutors and how they're handled by the courts. What do you feel is the takeaway from this particular case?
I think the takeaway is we saw yet another example of Franklin County appointing special prosecutors to try this case. Mm-hmm. We've had multiple police trials in this county since George Floyd was killed. And this was an example of them putting special prosecutors up and not getting a conviction. Mm-hmm. We just had Adam Coy, who was a former Columbus police officer. He was convicted of murder. They're appealing that, but that was not tried by special prosecutors. In this case, it was. Jason Mead, Franklin County SWAT deputy, was tried by special prosecutors that ended in a mistrial. And so we have Mead coming up again, and we also have another former Columbus police officer, Ricky Anderson, coming up with another trial. And I think that's my big takeaway of seeing these special prosecutors from Montgomery County try this case and not ending in a conviction.
Yeah, and the Adam Coy that you mentioned, there's an appeal that's been filed, so we don't know what is going to happen there exactly.
Yes.
Okay. What is Connor Grubb's status with Blendon Township's police force right now?
He is on administrative leave. I don't know if it's paid or unpaid, so I believe it's paid. And he hasn't – I asked the defense attorneys after the trial, like, hey, what's his future? Mm-hmm. Is he going to remain a police officer? And they said, hey, that's a decision he he doesn't know yet. Him and his family haven't discussed it yet, haven't decided. So if he stays on at Blendon Township, that would be surprising to me.
And then for Takiyah Young's family, have they mentioned any other legal recourse or if they're pursuing anything else? Are they going to, I don't know if they will appeal this or do something else.
They have two ongoing civil trials, one in federal court, one in county. In Franklin County, and you know, it's a wrongful death suit as well as filing for just damages in general for Takiyah Young's death and civil rights charges. Their two lawyers said that they, despite this verdict, they believe that the civil trials are their next avenue to be able to seek justice for Takiyah Young.
Well, WOSU News reporter George Shilcock, thank you for your coverage of the trial, and thanks for coming here to tell us about it today.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
Coming up, we're going to turn to State House news and a flurry of activity that lawmakers had before the holiday break, including a property tax bill that is on Governor DeWine's desk. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me on the roundtable this week, we have Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Andrew.
Happy Browns Victory Monday.
Oh, man. Okay. Yes. Yes, they did. I can acknowledge. And also with us is my fellow Steelers fan who's sad, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thank you for having me. Not so happy on this side of the table.
And then maybe who doesn't care either way, I don't know, Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here. I'm a Packers fan. So, you know, we did all right.
All right. All right. Well, on to Ohio politics and away from football for a moment. The marathon legislative session last week, lawmakers were heading out on break and they had a lot to get done. Is it just human nature that the General Assembly seems to wait till the last minute to take action on bills? Or is this a form of political procrastination? Or do any of you know, is this like a calculated move? Do they want to like stifle dissent and push a bunch of things through at night when everyone's tired?
I don't know that it's as much about stifling dissent, because a lot of the things that they passed for the most part did get committee hearings. I think it's more so like how you'd spend hours and hours and hours in the library the week of finals week. Mm. They set these deadlines, whether they're real deadlines, like in the lame duck period at the end of the 2-year GA, or they're fake lame duck, which is at you know, the end of the first year of the GA. All these bills roll over into next year, like nothing dies at the end of this year. But by setting a deadline like this, they're moving on things that they maybe wouldn't have.
Okay. So it's not necessarily procrastination, but just honoring a fake deadline.
Yeah. Maybe.
Maybe.
I think part of it, too, is they want to be done working for a few months. And so, you know.
Understandable. So do they just go home to their districts until January, or is there still work happening? My understanding is we'll get through each of the bills, well, each of the big bills, because there were 30 approved. But do we know if they're going to come back before the new year?
They have to come back in, well, the Senate has to come back in December to take up the hemp legislation that the House passed at like 2 a.m.
Okay. So that's probably going to be the only action that happens between now and the new year.
The House does not plan to come back before January 1st. And, you know, lawmakers had on the House side had different predictions about when they would come back. But typically in the second year, they don't come back till like at least February. But like Haley said, Senate will be back for just one session on December 9th. And a spokesperson said that they may take up some concurrence votes in addition to that hemp and marijuana legislation.
So they approved more than 30 bills last week on Wednesday. We don't have time to go through all 30, but we'll hit some of the highlights. So some of these measures passed one chamber, but not both. Everything's not a done deal. But the most significant one that actually is heading to Governor DeWine's desk is a major property tax cut that, and it delivers on Republicans, one of their top legislative priorities. So, Andrew, the House and Senate landed on about $2 billion worth of tax cuts. Is that right?
Yeah, the main driver of that is they changed the law so that when property values cause taxes to increase higher than the rate of inflation, if they were to happen in the future, this would cap it so that it can't do that. And sort of the big problem everybody's faced is that taxes have been going up solely because of that increase in values everybody's kind of seen over the last 5 years. And so that's the majority of where the property tax would come from.
But it's not just one bill. It's four bills. Can you summarize the key points?
Yeah. So two of them essentially do that. One is for school districts and the other one is for joint vocational school districts. But the other ones, there are two more that kind of have a variety of things. It's like one of them eliminates various types of levies that, man, it's like talking on a Monday about how the property tax formula works. they just kind of add up to make it more likely that if there's a big increase in values, that it translates to a big increase in taxes. So they're trying to kind of chip away at that by making school districts not, for example, be able to have what's called a substitute levy. There's another one that makes tweaks to a county a panel of elected officials that gives them greater authority to kind of unilaterally cut taxes, to review levies, you know, levy requests before they go in the ballot and stuff like that. So, yeah, lots of little and medium and big changes that kind of add up to what you said, more than $2 billion in estimated tax cuts over the next 3 years.
And Sarah or Haley, do we know if Governor DeWine supports these property tax measures?
Several of the policies are similar to what DeWine's property tax working group recommended earlier this year. That was the task force that he convened after he vetoed some property tax measures and the budget. So while he has not said for sure whether he's going to sign or veto this legislation yet, I think there's a decent chance he will support a lot of it because, again, these are similar, not exactly, but close enough to a lot of the suggestions that came out of that task force.
And
go ahead. I was going to say, does he have to sign it by a certain date? I don't know.
Yeah. So most bills, and it's kind of this loose situation because it depends on when like the legislature actually turns the bill over to Governor DeWine. But generally, he has 14 days to sign or veto. He was asked about a lot of the bills that he was being sent on Friday because he had a press conference with Mayor Andrew Ginther in Columbus, and he was asked about the property tax bill. DeWine is famous for saying he's not really going to talk about a bill before he signs it. But he highlighted that working group that Haley mentioned and that, you know, these bills aligned with a lot of those, but also mentioned that he didn't really like all of the recommendations that the property tax working group made. So we'll see.
And there's also a related property tax bill that would raise the voter approval threshold on property tax levies. Did anything come of that?
No.
Okay. No. Am I making it up, or is it just...
there was talk about that, and okay. It just wasn't what landed on the floor.
Yeah.
Something I wanted to throw in is that some of these bills got some Democratic votes, which, if we're kind of trying to read the tea leaves about whether Mike DeWine is going to be okay with them, you know, Democrats had the same kinds of concerns that DeWine did when DeWine vetoed some property tax changes over the summer, which would have basically cost school districts funding. That's sort of the flip side of the coin, obviously, is anytime you're paying less in taxes, it means some government service is not getting funded in the same way. And so the fact that some Democrats voted for this, you know, whether it's that they're concerned about the political pressure if they have to be on the ballot and say they voted against a tax cut, or whether it's, you know, more like kind of the some of the changes that kind of happened with the bill, you know, I just think that's significant. And maybe that would be a check in sort of the column in favor of DeWine being more okay with what ended up happening.
Yeah. I mean, some Democrats did vote no out of concern for school funding directly, but bless you.
My apologies.
That's okay. So some Democrats are worried about it. Maybe it depends on the school district and what levies they need. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I frankly think it has to do too with what I just said, which is that the political pressure they face from having to stand election and stuff like that.
Well, people want their property taxes to be lowered, and you know, they did support some levies, you know, more than half of the levies around the state. So if voters are going to support the levies, then lawmakers can lower the taxes, right?
Yeah, and one of the changes they made to one of the bills kind of shifted some of the tax burden away from people who live in their homes and towards people who don't live in a residential property, which often is like a landlord investment property type thing. So I think maybe that could be something that won some Democrats over. I mean, that some of them said that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. There was another bill, House Bill 184, to make sure name, image, and likeness contracts for college athletes end when their college eligibility ends. But then a whole lot more got added to this bill, Sarah. Why that one and what's all in there?
Yeah, this is what we call a Christmas tree bill. I think someone on the floor referred to it as like a stuffed turkey bill or something because it was around Thanksgiving. But what I mean when I say Christmas tree bill is that oftentimes when lawmakers wait until the end of the year to pass things, they need what they call a vehicle to pass it by because, you know, something can only get to the governor if it's passed both chambers. So some of the things in this quote unquote Christmas tree bill had to do with like budget corrections. It also put $40 million into a fund for first responders dealing with PTSI or post-traumatic stress. It changed the formula for how nursing homes get paid by the state. And it also makes a change to how publicly funded childcare is paid. It's now going to be based on attendance, not enrollment. So it made a lot of changes. Again, some of these have to do with what was going on in the budget.
Is that unusual, or do we always have at least one Christmas tree bill, as you call it?
Again, oftentimes there are a bunch of things that they want to get done that are, and these are the types of ideas that they maybe haven't gotten a bunch of debate or whatever. And some of them are maybe, I mean, you know, this post-traumatic stress portion, this $40 million fund, like that was, that got pretty strong bipartisan support. And, you know, there was one lawmaker who said she was a Democrat. She said she was only voting for the bill because of that $40 million, but she had issues with a lot of the other things going on in the bill. So it is not unusual for them to shove a bunch of unrelated provisions into one bill.
And did that Christmas tree bill just pass the House, or did it pass both chambers?
No, it passed both chambers. So my understanding is it's off to the governor because it was House Bill 184. So it started in the House. The Senate took it over, added all those provisions because it started as that NIL bill that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Senate sent it back to the House, and then the House passed it on concurrence, which means they agreed to the changes.
There were concerns raised about it being too hasty. Democratic Senator Bill DeMora said he's not a fan of these Christmas tree bills. He says there's too much stuff crammed into it at late hours, and he feels like he doesn't get to see it all. Are lawmakers voting on things and they don't even know what's in it?
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, you know, even the marijuana and hemp deal, like the final details of that did not come out until midnight on Thursday. And the House took a vote at 1:30 a.m. on Thursday. It's, you know, probably easier for a lawmaker to defend why they voted no on something that they didn't get to read in its entirety. And I believe Senator DeMora voted no. I know Senator DeMora voted no on that marijuana and hemp bill in conference committee. But lawmakers are absolutely voting on things that they haven't read cover to cover.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. We're sorting through some 30-plus bills that the legislature pushed through last week with Sarah Donaldson of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andrew Tobias from Signal Ohio, and Haley B. Miller from the Columbus Dispatch. Haley, let's get into this cannabis hemp bill a little bit more. We've mentioned it a few times. So lawmakers work to hammer out some kind of agreement on cannabis and hemp as well. The two issues have been merged, and the House passed a bill that will now have to go to the Senate. Can you walk us through some of the proposals of what they want to do here with both cannabis and hemp?
Yeah, so hemp was definitely the big hang up here, and it got more complicated when Congress passed a ban on hemp as part of the bill to reopen the federal government. So the House ended up aligning the hemp rules with what the feds passed, which basically says anything over 0.4 milligrams per container is not allowed. And so in Ohio, those products would be sold in licensed marijuana dispensaries. They did delay a hard ban on THC drinks for a year. That's been another big part of this debate because the THC drinks are very popular. A lot of breweries are selling them, and so there's a lot of concern about regulating those. So those will be like temporarily regulated for a year, and then the bill says that if Congress decides to change the rules as it relates to THC drinks, then Ohio could revisit that. On the marijuana side, they made some changes to the voter-approved law that was passed in 2023. They walked back some of the major changes they were considering, but they did, you know, tweak some things that, you know, frustrated people. For example, you can get a minor misdemeanor if you're traveling with marijuana and it's not in its original packaging, little things like that. So
the hemp federal thing won't take effect for a year. Like the thing that Congress did is a whole year from now, right?
Right. And I think there's a pretty widespread belief that lobbyists are going to use this year to lobby Congress to change the federal things. I think, you know, when this passed in Congress, they were just trying to get the government reopened, right?
Right. But what Ohio lawmakers are doing, they're mirroring what Congress did, but theirs will go into effect sooner if the Senate agrees, right?
Yep.
Okay. So what do we need to do still? The House passed it, but is this the problem? Is that it doesn't mirror what the Senate had already done? No.
So it was pretty procedural what happened on Wednesday in the sense that they were finishing negotiations. So although the full Senate hasn't voted on it and the full Senate still needs to take that vote on December 9th, it indicates that there's a deal because it passed out of what's called conference committee, which has both members of the House and members of the Senate on it. And the two Republican Senate members of the conference committee voted for the bill. So it represents a deal between the two of them. Now, of course, this is the most late stage deal we've seen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Haley and Andrew and I have been following this for 2 years and these deals have fallen through before. That being said, it's the Senate's intention to come back, pass it on December 9th. Then it'll go to DeWine. DeWine, as we talked about earlier, is always a little bit coy when he's asked about if he's going to sign a bill, but he's been asking for a ban on hemp. The one thing, and I think Haley said this, but I do want to note on the THC beverages, because this was a piece that was negotiated and was important to getting some people on board, because it was a tight vote in the House. Like 52 people voted to pass it. It's very rare that it's that close, because if only had a couple more had gone home or voted no, it would have failed on the floor. And that's why it took all day to negotiate it. Those THC beverages, there is language in the legislation that if Congress chooses to do something over the next year that would enable Ohio to, like, keep these beverages legal, then lawmakers will revisit the issue.
And the Senate was planning on passing this last Wednesday, but they basically got tired of waiting for the talks and the Senate president sent everyone home. So they're just like us, lawmakers. They don't want to wait all night for, you know, negotiations to take place.
Isn't there also a provision in this bill related to tax revenue?
Yes.
Yeah. So what happened there?
The local governments will finally get the revenue that they're owed under the recreational marijuana law. These are municipalities that have dispensaries. They're supposed to get about 36% of the tax revenue, but the state officials have said that issue two, the voter-backed statute, did not include language that would actually allow the state to distribute that money. So they've basically just been sitting on this revenue that's been accumulating. And a lot of local officials have been very irritated about it, but this bill would allow that money to be released.
So this is why the Columbus City Council president was asking for his money last week?
Yes. That yes. Okay. Yeah. And okay. It's been held as a bargaining chip. I mean, lawmakers have said, you know, because Democrats were asking on the floor on Wednesday, well, why couldn't we just like release this money standalone? And they tried to get it added, for example, to that Christmas tree bill. They were like, well, this bill has all these other provisions, so let's just add the host community fund in there. But Republicans have used this as a bargaining chip to get the legislation that they want on marijuana done. They're not going to release the host community fund until the Senate and the House come to a deal.
And even the overall bill has been a bargaining chip in that I think there's been universal agreement that selling psychoactive candy in gas stations where they don't legally have to card a child who walks in to try to buy them, that's bad, right? But they haven't been able to agree on what to do exactly because they've been rolling in, all no pun intended, all of these other hemp things and like this funding. And I think the theme of this segment is kind of what the actual process of legislating looks like. And sometimes it involves delaying action on things that have widespread acclaim or, you know, agreement. Sometimes it involves rolling out a deal and then asking people to vote on it when they're sleep deprived an hour later. So it's not really pretty, but you know, it is our legislature. It's how these things have always worked for whatever. It's like you said before, maybe it's like human nature that all this stuff kind of adds up this way.
Yeah, I agree. It sounds like finals week where you're not necessarily behind, but you feel like you need to cram.
It's so finals week in the way that I was walking through the basement of the state house at like 11 p.m. and lawmakers were going to the vending machine and getting like Mountain Dews. Like,
oh,
it's
man.
Just,
it's, you know, it's bad when the Mountain Dew comes out.
At 11 p.m.
Yeah. All right. Well, one more bill I wanted to get to before we take a break is the House last week passed a controversial bill known as the Baby Olivia Act. Why do Republicans want to require public school students to see a video on fetal development? Do we know exactly what this video shows?
I don't remember the nitty-gritty of what's on the video, but generally speaking, this has been pushed by opponents of abortion and other states. They feel like it should be a part of sex ed, health class, and this, to them, I think, is another tool to kind of discourage, you know, young people from wanting to get an abortion.
So the Republican bill was originally meant to include students from the third grade and up. It's been changed to fifth grade. Here's Republican Representative Mike Odioso explaining the change to fifth grade.
This is an age where students will be able to not only comprehend what they are watching, but be able to question the authenticity and scientific accuracy of this video.
Reproductive rights groups are among those opposing the bill. Jamie Miracle with Abortion Forward said Ohio is the only state in the country without health education standards.
So instead of creating comprehensive, age-appropriate, scientifically based health education standards, we've got these ridiculous piecemeal pieces that then just invite propaganda and misinformation into our schools.
I mean, I will say I'm not sure Mike Odioso knows many fifth graders, but we'll just leave it there about the fifth grader being able to, how did he say it, authentically and scientifically question a video. But anyway, so with this bill, did it pass the House?
Yes. So okay. It passed the House. Now it needs to go to the Senate. And, you know, a lot of this is lawmakers know that with Republican lawmakers, especially who, you know, continue to push anti-abortion policies, they know that it is going to be a question of whether it abides by issue one, that constitutional amendment that voters approved in 2023 that had to do with abortion rights. But of course, a lot of these things, these peripheral things that kind of have to do with abortion, but maybe not directly with abortion access, are going to go through the courts. And the Ohio Supreme Court is now a 6-1 Republican majority.
Mm-hmm. Oh, has the Senate indicated that they'll even take it up, or like
you have a? I mean, you have a lot of coalition of anti-abortion Republicans in the Senate as well. So I think that there's a chance that they take it up, but I don't know that they've been asked directly. I mean, there's still a year, so I will say that like a lot of the things that passed out of one chamber or the other on Wednesday probably represent a priority of something that lawmakers want to get done before the end of their second year legislating when everything goes to die.
Do you know if there's anything in this bill to allow parents to opt out, or is that in there?
Yeah, there is an opt-out language in the bill.
Okay. And do we know where this came from? I don't even know why it's named Baby Olivia.
It's a nationally produced video. So I'm assuming the bill has national ties as well, but it's a national anti-abortion group that has produced the video.
Okay. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about a bill related to elections and absentee ballots. And then we're going to get an update on the race for governor now that one key figure is no longer a contender. That's when the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. Still with us, we have Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter with Signal Ohio, and Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. One more bill that passed last week relates to absentee ballots. Those ballots will now need to be turned in by Election Day. There's no longer a four-day grace period. Republicans in the House and Senate passed this measure last week. Is Governor DeWine in favor of a change to the absentee ballots?
So this is my big question, because back in 2023, when Ohio enacted its new voter ID bill, DeWine said he signed it, but then he said, you know, I consider the issue of election integrity to be settled. I don't expect to sign any more big election bills while I'm governor. So I'll be interested to see what he does. What could complicate his decision is the fact that there's litigation before the U.S. Supreme Court on this issue. Mm-hmm. They're expected to hear a case out of Mississippi about whether these grace periods can be allowed or if absentee ballots need to arrive by Election Day. So I suspect that'll be a factor for him.
Do we know where this bill came from, Andrew? Did something go wrong with the four-day grace period? Like, why does it matter?
So I think it traces back to how in 2020, when there was a lot of mail-in voting that took place because of the pandemic, and you kind of saw states implement emergency rules to expand it and stuff like that. And even like states like Pennsylvania that approved something, they just happened to use it a lot for the first time. These late-arriving absentee ballots shifted the vote from Donald Trump was leading, and then when you actually counted all the votes, including those that came in, he lost. And Trump hasn't liked that. He's made his views on that very clear. And so now that he's back in power, you've seen him and the Republican National Committee, which is behind the litigation in Mississippi that Haley mentioned, and then the DOJ, which sued Ohio or threatened to sue Ohio about 2 or 3 weeks before this bill got introduced in October. So that's really where this all comes from. Mm-hmm. And whether it's a problem, you know, there's no evidence that these are in any way, there's something wrong with the votes, that they're fraudulent or something like that. Although that's something that the president likes to say a lot. But the argument the Republicans make for the bill is that it's not good for sort of just like people's trust to see the vote be something and then it actually change. But of course, there's still going to be what's called provisional ballots, which are ballots that if there's some kind of question about your registration, when you show up to vote, you cast what's called a provisional vote. And that basically gives elections officials extra time to verify you are who you say you are. Sometimes voters have to go in and actually provide information. And so those votes could shift the results of elections. So, but that's the question ultimately is, like, I guess increasingly in recent years, it seems like these late votes matter more and you can't just call the results in the election day. And I guess that's where this kind of comes from ultimately.
Go ahead, Haley. Yeah.
Yeah. And to Andrew's point about the provisional ballots, none of this changes the timeline for when an election actually gets certified, which happens a few weeks after the fact. But I think for a lot of people, the election is over at the end of Election Day. No one's hanging around waiting for election certification. So it's more of a perception thing than, I think, something that will actually affect procedure.
There is one local school district around here who had, like, whenever the votes were certified, the voting flipped, or the levy passed or didn't pass by 3 votes. I can't remember right now.
And that kind of thing happens all the time. Mm. It's, you know, and even I forget if it's different counties have different rules, but some counties, if not all of them, if there's a tie vote, you have to flip a coin, and you don't know if it's a tie until you actually certify the election. And but Frank LaRose, our Secretary of State in Ohio, kind of likes to bring up those instances because it shows what he'll just say, look, every vote matters. This one, you know, was settled by a single vote or even like the flip of a coin. So It does happen. It's just kind of, it goes back to these high profile instances like a presidential race. I don't think, you know, the DOJ is not getting all twisted up about some school levy passing or failing. So that's, but it is, you know, I think it speaks to how this is, you know, honestly, just like a political perception.
Yeah. Well, so how much are we going to have to rely on the U.S. Postal Service now? Like, you're going to need to get your ballot, because you could just, as long as your ballot was postmarked Election Day, your vote would count, right? But now you need it to be in the hands of them before that.
Yeah. So it always remains that you have to have your ballot postmarked before Election Day. You could still do that. And then you just sort of have to count on the Postal Service to get your ballot to the Board of Elections. So we asked Matt Huffman about this, or actually another reporter did last week. And he said, yeah, I live in Lima. If I mail something to the courthouse from my office, which I assume is like a few blocks away, yeah, it'll arrive the next day. But in big cities, especially in Cleveland, there are ways that the mail gets sorted and routed. That's a little more complicated than walking it down, you know, the street.
Walking down the street in Lima is very different than walking it down the street in Columbus, Cleveland, or Cincinnati.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, but it's just kind of the question is, how long will it take for the mail to get there?
Yeah.
For it to arrive before the polls close on Election Day. Actually, I'm sorry, it's when the office closes Election Day, so it's either 4:30 or 5:30.
Okay, so the mail. Okay. So we are relying on the Postal Service to be fast about it.
We are.
Okay. But we don't know whether Governor DeWine is going to sign this or not, because he doesn't talk about things ahead of time, right?
Correct. He was also asked about this on Friday, and he said he's going to look at the bill. So
all
we'll
right.
see.
We'll wait. All right. So the is he or isn't he running for governor game is over now. Former Congressman Tim Ryan will not challenge Dr. Amy Acton for the Democratic nomination for governor. Andrew, we've been waiting for this decision for way too long. So did we get any reaction from Amy Acton's campaign?
Yeah, we were talking about that off air before we started. Amy Acton issued a statement. The words Tim and Ryan were not in the statement.
Yeah.
The same for the Ohio Democratic Party chair, Kathleen Clyde. They both issued statements talking about Vivek Ramaswamy, kind of like turning the page on this, you know, possible primary to just fully focused on November 2026. So yeah, they issued a statement, but it didn't have anything to do with Tim Ryan's decision.
Haley, what do you think this means for Amy Acton's campaign now? Is she going to be able to move forward with more solid backing? Were people truly waiting for Tim Ryan to make a decision?
I think some people may have been, but it did seem like, especially the past few months, she was starting to get a lot more support. I think there were some parts of the Democratic Party who were tired of waiting, or maybe were just never going to support Tim Ryan. You know, I think another factor that was playing into this behind the scenes is that while Sherrod Brown, who is running for U.S. Senate, was not publicly backing anyone, you know, he didn't publicly endorse Acton, it was pretty well understood that he supports her. So I think there was a lot of that kind of behind the scenes dynamics happening as well. But this certainly will allow her to really consolidate support. You know, if anyone was hanging on to their checkbook waiting for, you know, a decision to be made one way or the other, you know, that could impact her.
And like just this morning, and I think this is new, but my wonderful colleagues can fact check me if I'm wrong. Like the Democratic Party, I'm sorry, it wasn't the Democratic Party, it was Amy Acton's campaign, sent out a release that the four big city mayors were endorsing Acton. So those are the types of Democrats who, if they maybe haven't weighed in yet, they're going to weigh in now.
And national groups maybe were looking at this and saying, I don't really understand Ohio politics, I don't want to get involved with this. I think that that sort of, you know, hindrance is gone too. And I do expect that this race will get more national money than what would be a normal governor's race. We usually see lots of national money come in for Senate races because there's, you know, a whole bunch of people who sit down and we really care about what's happening in Washington, D.C., and they kind of pull money to kind of allocate among the different races. But usually they don't really care about who's regulating Medicaid in Ohio unless it's an Ohio person. But for somebody like Vivek Ramaswamy, who has a national profile, I just think you'll see more natural interest both from people who like him and from people who dislike him to try to get involved here.
Yeah, Ramaswamy has a national profile, and then Dr. Amy Acton also has a national profile. I mean, people will remember her from the pandemic days, maybe.
Yeah, I think just with Ramaswamy, it's that he ran for president and that he may run for president again, and he's almost like a political celebrity. So Acton definitely
has... And he
has,
was a member of DOGE for a hot minute.
Right,
so.
Yeah. Acton, I mean, there are groups. There's a group called 314 Action that specifically is trying to get public health and people with medical backgrounds elected to office. So there are things like that in place, but... You know, like Ramaswamy, like I said, I can't put it any better than he's almost like a celebrity. And there's this whole kind of like fandom celebrity aspect of our politics now that ties up into that.
Well, and he's still, I mean, as much as he's campaigning in Ohio, I mean, he's still doing national stuff. I think he was in Montana somewhat recently for a Turning Point event. So, you know, he does still have that.
He's running for president and governor at the same time. Yeah. Andrew, you wrote about a former Ohio governor who backed Sherrod Brown back in 2024 and is now backing Ramaswamy. Tell us who it is and what does this speak to Ramaswamy's appeal?
Yeah, it was maybe, you know, a week or two ago, Bob Taft endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy. And it's not that surprising that a Republican would endorse another Republican. But we saw Taft actually endorse Sherrod Brown for Senate last year, even though, you know, Taft and Brown, you know, faced off in the 1990 election, and God knows what Bob Taft said about Sherrod Brown back then. So I think what's interesting about it is not only is that it takes somebody off the board who a Democrat might actually try to get an endorsement from, especially in a state like Ohio, where they have to get creative about who their coalition is. I think it also shows that Ramaswamy, for all of the like MAGA kind of posturing and kind of like packaging that's there, I think fundamentally underlying him is somebody who traditional Republicans can get with, too, or at least somebody like Bob Taft.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to touch on the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio ordered First Energy to pay a fine that totals $250 million related to its role in the House Bill 16 scandal. Here is PUCO Commissioner John Williams talking about the action they took.
They violated one of their most fundamental responsibilities, and that's maintaining the public's trust in their role as a public utility. I'm hopeful the remedies we approve today will serve as a strong deterrent against similar misconduct in the future.
So is this kind of like a finally situation, or did the, like, I don't know why it took 5 years, but is that what's the reaction around town to this fine?
I don't get the sense that the PUCO is the fastest moving body in the world. And I'm not a House Bill 6 expert by any means, but I do think that there was a little bit of a sense of finally, you know, we saw former Speaker Larry Householder, former GOP chair Matt Borges sentenced for their roles in the House Bill 6 scandal. But there, it was a utility at the heart of this, and a utility that serves a lot of Ohioans, that a lot of Ohioans use for, you know, their homes. So I think providing some of that relief back to ratepayers was an important step.
Yeah, and these investigations launched shortly after Larry Householder and all of them were arrested in the summer of 2020. And back then, there were some people who wanted to give First Energy, like, quote unquote, the death penalty, basically decertify them as a utility. Since the state regulates these things, they can, you know, dysregulate them too. And so they, I mean, $250 million is not something that First Energy is like excited to pay back to people, I'm sure. But, you know, it does show it could have been worse. And it, you know, like, it's kind of a moderate result compared to kind of what they're facing, like when this was really hot and when it first broke.
So what happens here? People who have First Energy as their utility company are going to get a refund?
Yeah, there's a some of it's complicated. But yeah. Some of it is going to be an actual refund, and I'm guessing it's going to be a very small amount that you might notice in like the fine print of your bill in the future.
And I believe they owe money to the state's general revenue fund as well. So it like goes out to customer, like very small amounts go out to customers, but some money will go back to GRF as well, which is the state's like general tax bucket.
All right. Well, we have less than a minute left. So what are we looking for this week ahead of Thanksgiving? Are we just waiting to see if Governor DeWine signs anything before Thanksgiving?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I have a feeling. I'm not a betting woman and I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know that he's going to take action on much before. He typically takes the full 14 days on bills that are maybe a little bit more controversial, or he's thinking about a little bit more. I mean, there have been some bills that he signed very quick, like Senate Bill 1, that higher education overhaul, but he typically takes the full 14 days.
If he wants no one to pay attention, he could sign it at like 4 o'clock on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, right?
He could.
All right. Thank you to Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you.
Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Haley.
Thank you.
And Andrew Tobias, state government and politics reporter at Signal Ohio. Thanks, Andrew.
Happy to do it.
And this has been the Reporter Roundtable from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.